The Rebel Capitalist Show, episode 135.
Welcome to the podcast that helps you build wealth and thrive in a world of out-of-control central banks and big governments. This is the Rebel Capitalist Show.
Hi guys, welcome to this episode of the Rebel Capitalist Show. No intro today. I just hit record because the conversation was absolutely amazing. I interviewed Lynn Alden and Jeff Snyder at the exact same time. I can promise you, this is one of the best pieces of content you will see all year. So let's go straight into the conversation where we start talking about quantitative easing.
We'll just start with what quantitative easing is, how it works, and what the back and forth on Twitter has been with bank reserves and what they can and cannot do.
Sure. How about you frame it, George? Because you probably have a better way of words than I would to set.
Well, I'll frame it if you want. It's neither quantitative nor easing. So let's just start there. the easiest thing, it's obviously not quantitative. Because if it's quantitative and if we have a bunch of, you know, the best and brightest Ivy League economists sitting around the table and discussing things and coming up with the right exact number, you only need to do it once, right? Because if it's quantitative, you know the number ahead of time, you do it, it works, everybody, you unpack it, it's done, everybody goes away happy. And, you know, given the experience in the United States, Europe, and now in Japan for more than almost two decades now, it's obviously not quantitative. Now, the bigger, more interesting discussion is whether or not it's actually easing. And that typically revolves around what happens with these bank reserves that get created as a byproduct of the buying process. And that's a whole different discussion. I think that's the discussion we're going to have here.
Yeah, exactly. So the back and forth on Twitter lately, Jeff, has been let's just use a primary dealer bank. If they have these bank reserves, are they able to go to the next auction and buy treasuries with those bank reserves, or do they have to use cash? Because obviously the back and forth is if they're using cash, then technically that may be taking purchasing power out of the economy, therefore almost taking liquidity out of the economy. But if they're using bank reserves, then it's kind of a wash. And then if they are buying those treasuries, and then those bank reserves go from the balance sheet of the primary dealer bank down into the TGA. And then once the treasury spends that money, then they're creating an additional bank liability in the commercial banking system, or they're increasing deposits that are potentially chasing the same amount of goods and services. So in my mind, that's kind of how I frame it to keep myself understanding it well, is I just kind of look at it as the commercial banking system's liabilities in aggregate, and then the Fed's liabilities in aggregate. And is action A, B, or C increasing the commercial banking system's liabilities? Because to me, and I could be wrong, that's kind of the key component to whether we're going to see consumer price inflation.
Well, number one, I mean, I don't know if Lynn wants to answer here, but I would just say, first of all, I don't know why we would even expect consumer price inflation, because again, history has shown conclusively that quantitative easing doesn't lead to consumer price inflation. The entire reason the Federal Reserve just conducted its almost 2-year exhaustive strategy review was because it can't do what it says it's going to do so far as consumer prices go. It does quantitative easing. It doesn't lead to consumer price. It doesn't lead to them hitting their CPI target or the PCE deflator target. So something's wrong in between already. And we already talked about quantitative easing obviously cannot be quantitative. So what are we missing in between? There's something missing between the Federal Reserve doing something and therefore how that's supposed to react or how it doesn't react on the real economy. We're missing something, right? There's something clearly missing from the equation. And so the next step is, well, what are they actually doing with this bank reserve process? What are we actually doing with quantitative easing? And the answer is it's a simple asset swap. And, you know, bank reserves have been historically nothing more than something like a clearinghouse certificate. And if you go back to the earliest days of the Fed, even before the Federal Reserve, you know, the United States banking system did not operate with a central bank because it had all of these private ad hoc clearinghouse associations. There was a New York clearinghouse, there was a Chicago clearinghouse, you know, St. Louis clearinghouse, all of these things that they undertook privately. They undertook most of the roles, the emergency roles of the central banks, which was currency elasticity. And the way they dealt with currency elasticity was they would issue something called clearinghouse certificates. So if one of the banks within their clearinghouse network got short of liquidity. You know, customers came in, took too much money out of the vault and therefore left them with a shortfall. So long as they were in good standing with the clearinghouse would issue them clearinghouse certificates so that they could stay afloat. They could use these certificates within the network, thereby allowing them to stay up in terms of, you know, keep current with all the various float and payment needs that are taking place in the real economy. But a clearinghouse certificate can't ever leave the interbank system. It's simply an accounting ledger, really, for within the system that allows banks to continue to participate as long as they're judged to be solid, good standing banks that the network still wants to continue to do business with. And the Federal Reserve, when it was first instituted in the early 20th century, followed what was called the Aldrich Plan. Now, the Aldrich Plan was written by a bunch of people, among them Paul Wahlberg, who simply wanted to replicate the clearinghouse mechanisms that were already in use in the public system. They just didn't want it to be left, you know, the famous case after, you know, the 1907 panic was they didn't want to be beholden to JP Morgan, for example, because JP Morgan was a big part of the clearinghouse, New York clearinghouse. So what they wanted was essentially a clearinghouse system, but in public hands, or at least more public hands. Everybody knows the Federal Reserve is not a public institution. It's a privately owned central bank that is actually a clearinghouse. That's really what it was set up to do. And so the clearinghouse certificates that it issues are bank reserves, essentially these things. They're a special account that's an interbank account that has no role outside of the interbank network system.
Okay, so no role other than it's a backstop to create additional loans, which would mean additional bank liabilities in the commercial banking system.
Yeah, and what makes it that, what's different for between the bank reserves and the clearinghouse certificates is simply that bank reserves at the Federal Reserve satisfy legal reserve requirements.
Okay, so if when I'm looking at quantitative easing, here's I'm thinking through it, and Lynn, I'm going to get you to chime in as soon as I'm done. I'm seeing that the cash, for lack of a better word, goes from, and it's on the Fed's balance sheet, it's a liability of the Fed. So the cash of the XYZ bank goes to buy that, let's call it a treasury. Then the Fed swaps the treasury. So the cash goes from the primary dealer bank down to the TGA. Then what happens is the treasury goes from the balance sheet of the primary dealer bank over to the balance sheet of the Fed, so it becomes an asset, and then they swap for bank reserves. And then the initial cash, let's say, is in the TGA. So then the treasury writes a check, let's say to Average Joe. Average Joe takes that check, deposits the check into his account. Therefore, the deposits in the commercial banking system have increased. And to back up that liability, there needs to be an offsetting asset. So the cash or reserves or digital units of measurement on the Fed's balance sheet go from the TGA back to the XYZ bank, wherever Average Joe banks and wherever he deposited that check. So is that the flow? Is that the process? Or is there something in there I'm missing?
Well, George, I think you're missing at the first step. The Fed has to, or the primary dealer bank has to create the cash first in order to buy the asset from the government at auction. And so there's different ways that, and I know this is the problem because we're getting involved into what is a cash and what is a cash equivalent. Right. Because there's no cash here. There's no physical, there's not stacks of Federal Reserve notes that are being transferred back and forth in armored cars with armed guards. That's not happening. These are simply ledger balances on a bank or a Federal Reserve Bank or the government. And the government has deposit accounts with JP Morgan and any other primary dealers. So they don't need the Fed's TGA account in order to conduct business with primary dealers. So if JP Morgan is buying at auction, they're going to create the cash, and they actually don't even have to create the cash as long as it follows along with strict warehouse accounting, because these are warehouses. These banks, these primary dealers, their entire job is to buy the stuff from the federal government or, you know, other primary market issuers, warehouse those securities, and then sell them off to the public over time. And so they're given special privileges to be able to do that. One of those is to circumvent normal accounting rules. They can use all sorts of different ways in their balance sheet in order to credit the government with essentially a temporary cash balance. So now we're getting really complicated. What all we really need to know is from what you just, the flow chart that you just developed, is that the first step in any of this is the primary dealer bank, not the Federal Reserve. The primary dealer bank has to create the cash asset, whatever it's going to use. It usually it's a deposit in the government's account to purchase the bond from the government at auction.
Mm, right, right. So,
it's already there to begin with.
Okay. So, Lynn, are you following this? And what's your input there? Can you help me understand that?
Sure. There's a bunch of different points to touch on there, and I agree with a lot of it. And if you start, for example, earlier on at the point where quantitative easing doesn't cause inflation, that part is true. So if you look back in history, for example, quantitative easing, especially alone, doesn't cause inflation because it doesn't ultimately result in too much money chasing limited goods, right? Because all it does is increase reserves in the banking system. And if you look at both the 1930s and then also if you look at, you know, the aftermath of the 2008 crisis, you know, what you're really doing is kind of increasing bank reserves in the system. It's not really getting out into the public. So, for example, in 2008, banks went into that crisis with cash levels that were about 3% of their total assets. And they were, you know, they increased all these kind of reserve requirements and capital requirements and all these new regulations that were laid on top of them. So now banks operate with a higher reserve, status. And quantitative easing essentially gave them that reserves by taking some of their assets off their books. It was an asset swap to kind of recapitalize them and then so that they could go forward with that higher reserve requirement. Mm-hmm. Historically, what tends to lead to inflation is if you get, either tons of bank lending, or if the federal government goes around the bank lending channel and just, does a lot of direct spending in the economy with massive deficits. And, in those situations, those deficits get monetized in the sense that bank reserves are increased for the Federal Reserve to be able to buy a lot of those treasuries. So it's not really extracting that capital out from somewhere else. It's extracting it from kind of that new void of reserves and then going into the broader economy. So we saw that in the 1940s and we've seen that a little bit here in the early 2020s to offset, the big deflationary shock they had. So I think it's important to separate, QE on its own versus, QE combined with, massive fiscal spending, as an example. Mm-hmm. And then if you look at just the fungibility of, reserves in the system.
And that first step that Jeff is talking about, I think, although it's extremely complex, I think that's really the sticking point. I know it is for me in my mind, just that first step when the primary dealer banks are buying the treasuries at auction, and then that purchasing power, for lack of a better word, goes into the treasuries account at the Fed. And that's kind of the sticking point. So
yeah, from a high level perspective, it's I've described before kind of the three bucket model where you have the reserves, you have the TGA, and then you have currency in circulation. And if you look at, for example, how much mortgage-backed securities and treasuries the Fed has acquired over the past any given time period, you'll see a corresponding increase in the combination of the TGA reserves and currency in circulation. And during, say, for example, that the TGA draws capital out. You'll see kind of a corresponding decrease in reserves. But as soon as they empty that TGA, reserves go back up. And it's because basically, the accounting actually is, as Jeff pointed out, it's not the intuitive thing you think about. It's not actual capital moving anywhere. But essentially what you see from accounting perspective is that as the TGA goes down, basically it ends up back in the bank system, reserves go back up. And so...
It's just one for one. It's actually, yeah, right. It's essentially, right. I think that's probably a really good way to put it, Lynn, is different buckets. You're just moving it from one to the other. It's not creating, right. It's not destroying. It's just moving it from one pocket to the next.
Yeah. And those three buckets are all the main liabilities of the Fed. So, they have these other little tiny liabilities, but their three main liabilities are currency in circulation, bank reserves, and the Treasury's account, the TGA.
So what I was trying to do, Jeff, is I was trying to figure out by looking at how these three buckets work with the Fed's liabilities on their balance sheets and what would make them increase and decrease and how that would or wouldn't translate to.
Oh, that's easy, George. That's the easiest question of all. What makes the Fed's balance sheet is entirely monetary policy. That's it. There's no other reason. It's all about the FOMC. So if the Fed is intending to increase its balance sheet, quantitative easing is nothing more than the means to do it. That's all quantitative easing is. It says, look, right. We got to get our balance sheet bigger. So the way we do it is by buying assets from the public. And that's a historical accident, too, which is probably worth a discussion down the road. But that's all it is. Quantitative easing is the means by which a central bank increases its balance sheet. And what happened, what I think most people go wrong is they're interpreting the Fed or any central bank increasing its balance sheet as doing something monetary. And that's right. Where I think we run into all these problems.
Yeah. And so that's what I'm trying to, if I'm understanding you correctly, when you're saying monetary, are you referring to the commercial bank liability? So the deposits in the real economy with held with the commercial banks, that's what I'm trying to figure out, if that's increasing or decreasing, excluding just additional or less bank lending. I'm just trying to start by taking baby steps saying, okay, if this happens on the Fed's balance sheet, is something going to happen on the balance sheets of the commercial banks as far as their liabilities, as far as customers?
It could. And I think it goes back to what Lynn just said. And I want to go back to what she said, because I think that's the entire crux of the argument here.
Okay.
Is it really where the difference, where we get not just inflation, but actual activity in the real economy is through credit? The supply of credit. When the supply of credit gets out of the banking system into the real economy, that's really monetary action in action. That's really the monetary system becoming activated. And so if the problem is, if we have something that is constraining the banking system, then it doesn't matter really what the Federal Reserve does, because it's trying to prod and cajole the banking system to do something, because it's not so simple as deposits moving left and right. The way the banks construct their balance sheets is incredibly complex. And so if they have any kind of constraints, and I know Lynn mentioned capital constraints over the last crisis, that's one of them. So if banks are capital constrained, if they're VAR constrained, or any number of constraints, then it really doesn't matter what the Fed does. The Fed can give them all the reserves they want, and the banks will still do nothing with them. So that's really the issue here with quantitative easing. The Fed is saying, we need to do something. We need to do something because the economy and inflation are not performing the way we want them to. So we're going to expand our balance sheet. And that's supposed to lead the banking system to doing something in the real economy. And that doing something in the real economy, that's where the inflation, that's where the growth comes from. So that's the theory. So we have the Fed expanding its balance sheet, but we don't have the inflation and the growth in the real economy. So what are we missing in between? And I think Lynn is exactly right, because then you start to zero in on the banking system itself. Not the central bank, but the banking system itself seems to be the stumbling block between what the Fed wants to do and what never happens in the real economy. There's something stopping that from going from one to the other.
George, I think you described that well with separating the Fed put from the government put, right? Because a lot of people are looking at the Fed as, you know, the Fed's going to backstop everything, the Fed's going to do this. Whereas, you know, in this environment, the more impactful thing is what the government does, what fiscal spending happens, things like that. Because either you have bank lending, which is not really happening. It's mostly kind of dead on arrival at the moment. Or the federal government goes around the banking system and just, you know, hands out money, or, you know, backstops loans, for example, the PPP loans, that's essentially going around the banking system, even though it's still going through the banking system. So there's kind of like that sort of fiscal put, right, is still a powerful force. And, you know, the Federal Reserve's kind of role is to assist with the Treasury, like liquidity, you know, things like that. Like we saw that liquidity issue in March, and they can expand bank reserves to maintain liquidity in the Treasury market. But really it comes down to, you know, in that sense, either bank lending or fiscal spending. And in the absence of bank lending, you know, when everything just kind of shuts down, you have this big deflationary spiral, that's when fiscal can come online and they can just shovel money in there. And that's what we saw, you know, from that period of roughly April. They passed it in late March, but we saw that from April to July. And lately that's been kind of shut off now. So and we're starting to see a lot of things roll over, because monetary policy itself is just kind of, it's ineffective in this environment.
Yeah, I think, you know, I mean, we talk about lending, and we saw the spike in commercial industrial loans, for example, as companies drew down on every bit of liquidity they could find.
Yeah, the revolver.
Well, here we had this example where bank lending was actually increasing at a historically high rate, which was a deflationary negative, because companies weren't borrowing to go out in the real economy and build new factories and buy new office space and things like that. They were battening down the hatches for, you know, a deflationary win. They were hoarding liquidity left and right. So again, they were telling the Federal Reserve in particular, doesn't matter what you do, Jay, we're not going to do anything with the money. It doesn't. You can create all the bank reserves you want. Those bank reserves stay within the banking system, or within the interbank banking system part of it. We're not going to do anything with it. We're sitting here. And so it's not even capital constraint. There's almost a willingness constraint. The banks are not willing to take any risk right now. And so long as they're not willing to take any risk, they're not going to. It doesn't matter what the Fed does. They can give them all the bank reserves they want. They're simply saying, we're in preservation mode, not risk mode.
Yeah. And how does government spending play into that, Jeff? Is there a way for, like Lynn was saying, for that government spending to get around the banking system as far as creating more purchasing power in the real economy without having to create additional loans, without having the banks, without the banks needing to be willing to make that happen?
Yeah, I would agree that's a possibility. I might disagree with her slightly, and I don't think that that's happening right now, and I don't think it's happened since April. Because I think, look, the federal government can do helicopter money, and it has done helicopter money. We've seen it before. We saw it in 2008 with the Bush tax cut, same thing. So what the federal government can do is it can provide liquidity to the household sector and the business sector as it's done this year. However, I don't consider it to be stimulus because it's not adding anything to the economy. They're trying to make up for what's already an enormous deficit. The real economy has broken down, and that when it was shut down, we had the normal channels of redistribution in the economy, which are income, spending, you know, investment. Those things were stopped. And so the federal government is simply trying to bridge that gap with its direct aid through these various programs. So the federal government can get into the real economy and give it aid, but it's not the same thing as replicating all the process of income, profits, earning, investment. It's not the same thing at all. So it's sort of like a temporary stopgap measure to hopefully stop the bleeding. That's not stimulus in my mind. I think that's simply just aid.
I agree. It's an offset because, for example, you know, back during that March kind of crash, a lot of people were expecting more and more deflation. And we probably would have had that. We would have had a sharper thing. Now, the big kind of, you know, because we've seen, for example, let's call it inflation in grocery prices. But if people didn't even have the money, like that would have been even more constrained. So if we saw that big kind of deflationary spiral happen and you didn't get kind of any sort of those enhanced unemployment checks or those one-time stimulus checks, then we would have probably seen negative CPI prints. You probably would have seen, you know, kind of a sharper a pull down there. So what they did was you call it stimulus, but it's stimulus against, you know, a big deflationary shock. So it's really aid is probably the best word because all you're doing is kind of counteracting a portion of that big contraction. So you're just making the contraction less deflationary and kind of, you know, they've managed to boost up inflation expectations and a little bit of reported CPI. We've seen a rebound in commodity prices. So it kind of offset part of that big deflationary shock. But yeah, that so far is a one-time thing. And we've seen, you know, we saw consumer confidence, you know, different measures of sentiment and confidence rebound a little bit, but then it kind of languished there because, you know, now they're looking down the pike and they're seeing, okay, permanent job losses is still going up. There's still a lot of high debt in the system. Yeah. And so we're starting to see small business revenue kind of roll over. And so it's kind of the question now is like, okay, what's next? It's kind of like a big hungry beast, and it's almost kind of limitless in how much aid it would need to restart that sort of cycle. Because right now, you know, with such a big unemployment shock and with so much debt in the system, it's, you know, it's really kind of a big solvency issue potentially playing out. And right now, you know, we'll see what happens. Fiscal policy is currently in gridlock, and I'm not a political expert, so I don't really have much of an edge in forecasting when or how they're going to pass whatever the next thing is.
Well, yeah. You know, I kind of see it as like a rolling deflationary shock. It's like it wasn't a one-off event, just like 2008 wasn't a one-off event. It wasn't a one-time event, or it wasn't a single event. It was actually a series of events that happened. And I think, you know, what you just said, Lynn, I think that put it perfectly, because businesses, markets, wherever you look, people are wondering, are we through? Is this thing really done, or is that just the first step? You know, did we get the whole thing, or did we just get the first part of the thing? And I think that's what's keeping this, you know, deflationary mindset up front and center, especially in the bond market, is the idea that we haven't seen the entire thing yet, and that there's still possibly, you know, as Lynn said, the government is kind of keeping everything hopefully treading water. But if it takes this much effort for everything to just tread water, what does that really say about the underlying condition? And so I think that's, you know, the unemployment shock and everything else, there's a huge gap here that isn't being filled in efficiently and quickly enough that is causing this level of uncertainty. And so I think of it more of as a rolling deflationary shock that's more and more being uncovered as not simply a one-time thing. And so we're starting to see what might be the next leg of it, if there is a next leg of it. Some of that's starting to I think impact in the real economy and not just the marketplace too.
Yeah, so we have this tug of war going on with the real economy wanting to deflate. It wants deflation. It wants to get all that excess malinvestment, let's say, out of the system. And then on the other end of that rope, we've got the government and the Fed doing everything they can to prevent the economy from deflating. So I think for most of the viewers right now who are watching this, they're probably thinking to themselves, okay, does the government have the ability to win the tug of war, right? If they came out tomorrow and just, let's say, spent a quadrillion dollars into the real economy, would that outweigh the deflationary pressures? Or what would happen then, Jeff? Just as a thought experiment, what do you think?
Well, again, we go back to historical examples. Japan's a perfect one. It didn't matter what the Bank of Japan did combined with the Japanese government. They never got the inflationary. They never got the growth. And they kept doing bigger, bigger, bigger. I mean, QQE, which was started back in April of 2013, is now in its eighth year. So bigger, bigger, bigger doesn't appear to be the answer. At least, you know, that's the way I say it. Again, because it's not quantitative, neither nor is it easing. And then you can add the fiscal component to it too, as the Japanese have been doing pretty steadily for the last 30 years, and it doesn't necessarily lead to inflation either. So really, it's not necessarily about the size of the program. It's more about the conditions behind it. As you just said, Jordan, I think you put it perfectly. The Feds, the Federal Reserve, and the federal government are trying their best to hold the forces of a deflation at bay, because there are the forces of deflation that are out there. I mean, it's not that the economy wants deflation. The economy has to undergo deflation given the conditions and constraints that we have on it right now. And as the banking system, which is traditionally the agent by which you counteract those deflationary forces, continues to say, I don't want anything to do with this. There's really a limited means for anybody to really offset, which is really a tremendous mess.
Okay, so Lynn, yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, I would add that I think magnitude is a big question to consider. So if you look at the Japanese example, you know, their biggest deficits were like 8% a year, right? I think they're going to have a bigger deficit in 2020. I haven't looked at their numbers in the past couple of months. But if you look at historically, their biggest deficit was about 8% of GDP. So if you know, George, you mentioned the number quadrillion or whatever, but like basically if you use silly number, yeah, if you use like a silly number, which I think is actually a good thought experiment, if you use like a silly number and just say, okay, everybody, you know, instead of $1,200 checks, everyone gets $120,000 checks, right, then yeah, you'd see like currency itself would be, you know, a lot less meaningful in that sense. If everyone, you know, has a big kind of six-figure injection at that, you know, and then the Federal Reserve kind of, you know, increase its, you know, they bought all, you know, most of that through the banking system, and just kind of because there's no way that the existing balance sheets would be able to absorb that much fast treasury issuance. So you'd have to, you know, the Federal Reserve would, most of that would wind up in the balance sheet. You'd have a big increase in the monetary base, and then all that capital would go right to bank deposits, and people would have their accounts flush with cash. Then in that sort of extreme environment, then yeah, you'd have, you know, an inflationary spike, and you'd have like, it'd be disarray in productive capacity, because it's like how do you do investment when those kind of like crazy numbers are happening? So basically I would answer the question by saying that sure, like, you know, any authority that has kind of unlimited, you know, printing capability, like they can just do whatever they want with how many zeros they want, then sure, they can override a deflationary shock. But I think it's a question of, you know, what is the most effective way to do it? What has historically happened in history? And usually what they do is they do just enough to try to offset it, right? So you know, we had this big deflationary shock. We had a, you know, $2 or $3 trillion, you know, kind of injection here in the US, and that just kind of offset it, part of it. And I think it's kind of like, you know, now that the market's up and now that, you know, things are kind of at a standstill, we you know, there's not kind of riots, you know, aggressively happening now that like they were back then. I think it's easy for policymakers to sit back and just kind of, you know, they're going to debate with each other. And then till either we get another big, you know, asset price sell-off, or we get more civil unrest, or whatever the next catalyst may be, then they'll do another round. Maybe it's $1 trillion, maybe it's $2 trillion. It's still small relative to the, you know, the tens of trillions of dollars of debt in the system and the sheer kind of disinflationary weight to that. I think eventually, given enough time, they can print their way out of it. But it's I think people are often kind of too quick in how that plays out. I think people are, I mean, I saw, for example, when they were printing the, you know, when they were kind of doing that big fiscal injection earlier this year, I saw people calling for like hyperinflation by the end of the year. And it's just not, it's offsetting a much larger disinflationary shock.
Right. Yeah. So Jeff, what do you think about that? And then how, and again, I want to go back to I'm almost sure every single viewer right now is saying, Jeff, how can you say that? Because my grocery bill is going up by $100 every single week. So how can you sit there and say there's deflation? So let's go from a super, super high level complex discussion to kind of just bring it down to the average Joe here. How do we explain grocery prices going up?
Well, grocery prices aren't inflation. I hate to defend the Federal Reserve here, especially, you know, the famous Bill Dudley comment back in 2010 and 2011, where he said, you know, iPad prices are falling and therefore, you know, I know your grocery bill is going up, but that's right. I mean, let's define our terms. Inflation is the broad-based general rise in consumer prices. It's not one segment of the basket or another segment of the basket. And yes, there are all sorts of arguments about whether or not we can accurately measure inflation or not. I mean, does the CPI do it better than the PCE deflator? You know, I mean, there's all sorts of discussions about that. But the fact of the matter is broad-based general sustained levels of consumer price advances are not happening. And to point out, you know, something Lynn mentioned earlier, the core CPI, which is something that is, I mean, it's straightened out essentially on purpose, actually fell for 3 months in a row for the first time ever, which, okay, yeah, maybe we can't measure inflation accurately if you want to take that discussion. However, we can see signals of deflation in these various other estimates like the core CPI. And when it fell for three months in a row for the first time in history, the last time it had fallen in back-to-back months was in 1981 and 82, which was one of the worst recessions that we had had prior to 2008 and 2009. So what we're saying is that, okay, if we can't really measure inflation accurately enough, we can at least see signals of deflation when they do show up in something like the core CPI. Now, what I would say is that, look, yes, I know grocery prices are going up, healthcare prices are going up, education prices are going up, but those are being balanced out in other things in the real economy, which this year in particular, more and more things are being discounted than they ever had been, than they had at least in the last couple of years, which is offsetting those things. And so, look, you go to the grocery store, you pay a lot more for food. You notice that. That's something that sticks in your mind. If right. your wireless phone bill goes down for, you know, $20, $30 a month, you maybe don't notice the same thing. So even though the CPI picks up both of those things and you say, well, My grocery bill is going sky high. This can't be right. The CPI must be wrong. It's what people mostly notice that matters.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, I think kind of separating into different categories helps people kind of work through it. And a general trend we've had is actually we've had decent inflation in essentials or things you can't offshore or services. There's a couple of different ways to describe it. So we've seen healthcare go up pretty dramatically. We've seen education go up pretty dramatically. We've seen food prices go up recently, you know, kind of sharp. On the other hand, we've had a lot of electronics deflation, right? Because technology's, you know, kind of increased productivity there so much, as well as labor offshoring. So for example, a TV costs way less than it did, you know, an equivalent TV, high-end TV costs way less than it did 10 years ago, less than it did 15 years ago, and it's way better. So that's an example of tremendous deflation, and it's the good kind of deflation, right? Because it makes, you know, a really good TV accessible to almost everyone versus, you know, it used to be like a high, you know, those plasma TVs used to be like high-end items. Now, like anyone can get a $300 TV that's better than those. And so you have kind of that dichotomy going on recently. It's also, I think, you know, partially a matter of wealth concentration because we've seen, for example, inflation in high-end luxury goods to some extent. For example, we've seen, like, say, how much you know, kind of top paintings go for because there is so much money up in the top echelons that it can chase kind of those finite goods. So you've seen kind of massive increase in prices of fine art, for example. Whereas you don't have a lot more money down in the lower levels, so you don't have a lot more money chasing, you know, limited goods in the system. So people aren't getting, you know, there's not a ton of industrial production increase. There's not a lot of investment happening at the kind of lower levels. And so there's several different kind of intersecting forces. And it is, you know, to Jeff's point, far more complex than just what is your grocery bill saying? Because there's so many different kind of baskets of goods. There's so many different, it's kind of, you know, what's happening in the higher level versus the lower level, what's happening with essentials versus discretionary, that sort of thing.
I think that's it. I mean, Lynn, that's it exactly. What we're really talking about, inflation versus deflation, is not necessarily consumer prices themselves, but consumer price increases, sustained broad general consumer price increases as a symptom of an economy that is actually functioning, that's redistributing wealth and activity and profits and earnings and spending, all these things across all levels of society. And what Lynn just said was like, look, one of the reasons we're not getting inflation, we see it in the high end because people are in the high end of things are doing really well. that's a sign that the economy is not working as it's designed, that quantitative easing is not leading to the banking system doing the things we need it to do. We're not getting the broad-based monetary redistribution through credit that would be a symptom of an inflationary growth scenario. So the lack of inflation is not necessarily deflation. We're not talking about 1930 anymore. We're not talking about prices crashing at 45% rates.
Yeah.
What we're talking about is essentially the symptom of the monetary system, malfunctioning, in my view, which isn't allowing economic growth to reach every single part of the economy that we would see in a healthy scenario. What we would see is that money and activity and spending and all these good things would penetrate all level societies. Instead, it's being stratified, especially in the top levels, which suggests that, look, we're seeing an economy that's malfunctioning. And then we have to figure out why it's malfunctioning. And so that's the disinflationary drag, not necessarily, you know, textbook academic deflation, but it's a disinflationary signal that's a symptom of an economy that isn't working in the way it's supposed to. And so that's what I'm talking about. I'm talking about, okay, we're not seeing the growth. We're not seeing a wide enough proportion of the economy benefiting from the normal process that we expect an economy to generate. And so that's giving off this disinflationary signal that even the Federal Reserve has finally admitted it finally sees the same thing too. You know, the fact that they have been unable to hit their inflationary target for over a decade is a sign that something's amiss here. We're missing something. Something's not working. And I think Lynn just hit it right on the head. It's the fact that we're not seeing broad levels of economic activity that would allow this inflationary environment to develop. We're not even getting to that far. So, you know, it's not your grocery bill. It's the lack of economic growth that goes into all the stuff you don't see beside the grocery bill.
We talked about the commercial banking system not being willing to lend out money because they're looking around them saying, we don't want to take on this risk. But do you think there's a demand component to it as well, Jeff or Lynn, where we've pulled so much demand forward from the future with these super low interest rates that now people are just, they're not making enough income to take on more debt? Like they don't have the balance sheet capacity. Do you think that's a component of it as well?
I think so. If you look at, one of the works I do is I look at the long-term debt cycle, which was partially popularized by Ray Dalio. But basically, if you look over the long term, you have these short-term business cycles. And every time you have kind of that deleveraging event, policymakers rush in, they cut interest rates, they try to encourage more lending. So over the course of several of those business cycles, that they end up getting, you know, they never fully deleverage, they partially deleverage, and then they start leveraging back up again. While meanwhile, interest rates never hit their previous highs, they keep hitting lower lows. So as kind of that cycle plays out, you get lower interest rates, you get higher and higher debt levels. And that's not, you know, that's inherently deflationary. That's not, most of that debt is not productive. And then eventually policymakers hit the zero bound. So they did that in the early 1930s, and they did it again, you know, during the 2008 crisis, right? So when you hit the zero bound, that's when monetary policy becomes even less effective. And historically, you know, during both of those periods, you had, you know, you have that very high debt levels, you have very weak lending because there's already so much debt in the system, there's so much risk, there's not a lot of productive, you know, kind of investment happening, you know, outside of certain key areas. So for example, we have a lot of tech development happening right now, but that's a pretty small percentage of the labor force in the grand scheme of things, and kind of a small part of the economy, especially for, you know, kind of the bottom half of spenders, for example. And so historically in that environment, that's when the banking system kind of seizes up, and then you run into these larger deficits and these other ways that usually fiscal policymakers try to go around the banking system because there's so much debt in the system. And even from a banking perspective, there's just not a lot of reason to lend outside of kind of very targeted areas.
This podcast is brought to you by Rebel Capitalist Pro, the best online investing research. I have teamed up with Chris McIntosh and Lynn Alden, two of the best in the business, to create Rebel Capitalist Pro and give you the tools you need to build wealth and thrive in this crazy world of economic insanity. Rebel Capitalist Pro is jam-packed with Chris and Lynn's incredible research. We have live stream Q&As where you can ask your questions directly to Chris, Lynn, and myself. And the best of all, there's an online member forum which allows you to network, learn, and explore ideas with like-minded individuals. What are you waiting for? Check out Rebel Capitalist Pro right now at georgegammon.com/pro. That's georgegammon.com/pro. Take action today and do something your future self will thank you for.
Does the Fisher equation play into that, guys? Because what's going through my head when you're saying that is I've heard Lacey Hunt talk about if the Fed pegs the overnight rate at zero, let's say, and we actually do have deflation, then according to the Fisher equation, the more the economy is deflating, if the Fed is pegging the overnight rate at zero, real rates are actually going up, and that would prevent lending. That would prevent those loans from happening because those real rates are going up and up and up. So does that have something to do with it? And if it does, is the only, I don't want to say solution, but would the Fed then have to get ahead of the curve and then just go dramatically negative to make real rates negative and therefore try to stimulate? And I'm not saying that would work. I'm just saying
that's the whole theory behind quantitative easing, George. I mean, that's what they've been trying to do since 2008. The whole point of quantitative easing is not about bank reserves. That's just a byproduct of the process. What the Federal Reserve is trying to do is create inflationary expectations. What they're trying to do is get people to believe in this inflationary process, and that will drive real rates into the negative. Constrained by the zero lower bound, academic monetary policy thinking believes that the only way you can go around the zero lower bound is by creating inflationary expectations. And so if everybody believes bank reserves is money printing, then everybody will act as if that money printing will be inflationary and the Fed will get its negative real rates today. And the reason it doesn't work is because people in the banking system, number one, as we talked about, is constrained. Therefore, it's not going to create the credit that it needs to actually make these inflation expectations into something real. But beyond that, what happens when people in the economy and the marketplace begin to realize the Federal Reserve is a powerless organization that can't create inflation? Then they may want to create negative real interest rates at the zero lower bound. But what happens instead? You get stuck in this deflationary spiral where the more the Fed does, the more the marketplace and the banking system in particular knows it's not going to work. Therefore, they actually harden what they called in Japan this deflationary mindset. And so it actually works against it. But, you know, this rising nominal, rising real interest rate scenario is not the thing itself. It's not that real interest rates are the problem. They're describing something else that is the problem. That's the way that the economists are saying something's wrong because the nominal or the real interest rate must be extremely high. Well, what is it that's actually wrong? And part of it is, as Lynn, I think we just talked about, the banking system is the means by which credit and money flows through all tiers of the economy. That's what banks are really good at. I mean, we talk about Wall Street, and we're very hard on some of these banks and some of the things they do. But we need those banks to actually, unless we're going to do a different kind of a system, we need the banking system to operate at full capacity so that we can get liquidity, we can get money, we can get credit into all levels of society. So that small businesses have credit, not just the biggest businesses, that everybody has access to all the economic functions and not just certain parts of the economy. That's what's really held everything back. And it's nothing the Federal Reserve can do to get the banking system to allow this entire redistribution system, this redistribution function working. And it's not just inside the United States either. When we talk about the Eurodollar and the global monetary system, it's a problem for the entire global economy, because now you have not just certain parts of the U.S. economy that aren't working. You have entire places across the global economy that aren't working either because they can't get the monetary resources they need either. So the constraint on the banking system and the Federal Reserve's inability to solve that constraint is what they describe as high real interest rates.
Yeah. So Jeff, let me ask you a question. And then Lynn, I'd like to get your thoughts on this on Jeff's answer. So is it possible to fix the U.S. economy without fixing the euro dollar system?
No, I think it's not. I think the only way we're going to be able to fix the economy, especially in the long run, we can get it working a little bit here and there, as we saw in 2017 or 2014 or 2010. You know, it seems to progress a little bit and then it sputters again. And it's even worse in the rest of the global economy. So if we're talking about a long-run solution, I think we need to replace the system. We need to replace the Eurodollar system. I would prefer to see one that isn't entirely bank-centered, because obviously we've seen the downside of what happens when it sputters and when it doesn't work right. We need to find a system that works on all levels and does so predictably in a long-term fashion.
Okay, Lynn, what do you think?
I agree with that. I think if you get a partial kind of dollar devaluation, you can have one of those like 2017 periods where you get kind of a relief from it temporarily. I think the system as currently structured is at the point where it's not really good for the U.S. or the rest of the world anymore. And I think that goes all the way back to the Trippin's dilemma, essentially. You basically had multiple decades where the dollar is the global reserve currency. At the same time, the U.S., you know, after World War II, the United States was almost 40% of global GDP because it was kind of the last man standing after that, you know, everything that happened. Then you had kind of the rebuilding of Japan. You had the rebuilding of Europe. You had, you know, the rise of emerging markets, especially China. And so now the U.S. is a much smaller percentage of global GDP. It's like 20 some percent now. It's like, you know, roughly 20%, and even lower if you look at purchasing power parity. It's in the teens based on that metric. And it's no longer the biggest commodity import in the world. You know, that's China now. And so we're trying to run this system for decades now, even though, and it's all running on, you know, one country's currency. And then it's all this big unregulated kind of euro dollar. It's just like it's a really kind of a messy situation now. And basically, if you get kind of that constraint in the amount of dollars kind of floating around and all that leverage built on it, you get these big kind of dollar denominated debts, you know, denominated, you know, in you know, it's dollars. So those countries can't print dollars. They can't kind of offset. They can't devalue their debts. And so the system's kind of, you know, I think at its limit. And in the U.S., you know, we don't have the problem of the, you know, the debt denominated in a currency we can't print. But essentially what we have done is, because there's all this persistent demand for the dollars, you know, we run kind of persistent trade deficits. Now, that's mostly impacted the goods. So we have a mild services surplus, but we have decades and decades and decades of persistent goods deficits. And so the overall, you know, thing we've seen is we've kind of seen out of like a hollowing out of our manufacturing base. And we've seen kind of a transition to a very services oriented economy, which is partially that's part of why we have so much wealth concentration. You know, a lot of it's kind of monetary policy, but the other half of it, because we do have more wealth concentration than most of the rest of the developed world. And that's because, you know, in part because we have this big kind of center around technology and banking and government. And we've kind of hollowed out a lot of that blue collar work. The skilled kind of craftsmen, unskilled work. All that kind of blue collar stuff, we've really kind of exported a lot of it, and it's partially based on how we structured the system. And decades ago, we had a lot of benefits from it. You know, it was described as an exorbitant privilege. And I think I've seen Jeff before describe it as an exorbitant burden now. And I would agree with that it really, at this point, it weighs almost everyone down the way it's currently structured, including the U.S. It's just kind of it's a very kind of messy system that doesn't really benefit even us anymore, let alone others.
Yeah, and that's a really good point, Lynn, because it's one I try to make all the time, because one of the arguments against, you know, doing something about the euro dollar system is, oh, the U.S. will give up this exorbitant privilege that it has with the dollar denominating, you know, everything is denominated in U.S. dollars. And the point I make, you know, all the time that you brought up is that, look, it doesn't even work for Americans, but we don't realize it because we're inside the U.S. We're inside essentially a dollar bubble. We don't see the direct impact between a currency system that doesn't work and the effects of that. Whereas the rest of the world, they can see that because their currencies move in direct proportion to, you know, you made the point, Lynn, about, you know, countries should be devaluing their currencies as a way to get around this. Well, they're devaluing their currencies, but they're being devalued involuntarily. And the result of that isn't a way out of their mess. It actually makes the mess even worse. So people can realize outside the U.S., they can see the direct relationship between a currency system that doesn't work and the economic consequences of it. So we have a bigger task in front of us to talk to Americans and say, look, you have to realize that the U.S. dollar system as it's currently constituted doesn't work for you either. So even if we give up the U.S. dollar as a reserve and go to something else, whatever that might be, it's not necessarily a bad thing. It's not like we're giving up something that's really valuable. It's we're getting rid of something that's trash and hopefully going to something that benefits everybody. And there is a way forward to do that. It's just, I think, first of all, there has to be a political understanding that that's the case. The case right now is the global dollar system, as it actually exists right now, doesn't work for anybody.
Right. And Lynn, you mentioned, or you used the word structured. We structured the economy, but I think it's interesting in the sense that I don't know if the economy was structured this way or it was more reactionary. Meaning that we have the euro dollar system and the economy gets built around that, as opposed to us actually being proactive in building an economy around this year. I think it was maybe even more reactionary. Therefore, since it was reactionary, we don't know the problem because we don't understand that we were just building this economy around this other system that has more control or more impact directly. That, I know I'm probably not saying that.
The Austrians call it Cantillon effects. And the Cantillon effect says as money enters the system, it benefits those closest to the money entering the system, which is if the bank system and the banking system and the euro dollar are the ones that create the money, that new money creation is going to benefit the banking system the most. And that's what we have. That's what we had happen for decades. As Lynn pointed out, you know, the U.S. lost its industrial base financed by this Eurodollar system. And inside the U.S., it was replaced by essentially the FIRE sector. We had this enormous increase in banking and insurance and you know, all real estate and these, you know, credit bubbles and things like that. So the U.S. even got the worst of the buildup of, you know, globalization. We got the worst end of it because we lost real jobs, productive jobs that are good middle class jobs, and replaced them with this shaky, ridiculous, often insane and stupid financial system that now doesn't even benefit us in that way. So, you know, it's not really a hard case to make to the even people in the United States that the system hasn't really worked for a long time. It's just that I don't think people are aware of it. And they keep going back to, well, you know, Ben Bernanke, Jay Powell, Janet, you know, these people seem smart. They seem to know what they're doing. We'll give them the benefit of the doubt. They'll do all this money printing and QE. That seems like it. Maybe it'll fix things. We'll let them handle that kind of stuff. And we won't ask any bigger questions.
Just to touch on your point, because you asked about how intentional it is. I would describe it as kind of like, you know, Frankenstein's monster, because you had an intentional element to it, right?
Yeah.
But then it got out of control. So, you know, right. The for example, the petrodollar system is in part an intentional construct. You know, the U.S. wanted, you know, most commodity pricing and particularly oil pricing to happen in dollars. So even if France buys oil from Saudi Arabia, it happens in dollars, even though it's none of their currencies. And that was kind of an original kind of intention. And, you know, we've had kind of military kind of endeavors to kind of enforce part of that. And we've had kind of sanctions on any, you know, kind of entities to try to go around that petrodollar system to some extent. And so, you know, it's partially an intentional design, but it's one that got out of control because of the whole euro dollar market. And it's no longer serving kind of the original purpose that, you know, however unintentioned it was meant to serve in the first place. And, you know, I think the you know, kind of he described it well with with the industrial base out of the way, it's really what we have left is the FIRE sector. So we have all, you know, there's maybe 10% of us or 15% of us that have kind of benefited from this system, right? So if you work on Wall Street, if you work in government or lobbying government or kind of, you know, around the whole DC complex, you know, if you work in tech, right, in kind of low labor intensive, high margin, you know, those sort of industries, then you can benefit a lot from it because you kind of get some of the benefits of the global reserve status. So you have kind of a strong currency, but you're not really getting any of the downsides. Whereas if you're kind of anywhere in you know, call it the bottom 80% of or so, and especially as you get to the lower levels at the bottom 60%, the bottom 30%, that as you go down that kind of spectrum, that's when you get more and more of the burdens from it and less of the benefits. And
it wasn't broad enough, right? I mean, the benefits from globalization, at least in the U.S., it was in some places else, but the benefits of globalization and this financialization of the economy were not broad enough to carry the economy going forward when the financialization part of it run into trouble as it did in 2007 and 2008. That's what we're really seeing inside the U.S., the consequences of that, where we don't have enough of the FIRE sector to offset the lost industrial basis. In some ways, it's a relatively simple thing. And because we don't have the banking system make up the difference anymore, how do we, you know, there's your lack of inflation. There's your lack of distribution throughout the entire global economy. And as Lynn said quite well, that, you know, it concentrates everything into the pieces that did work or pieces that do work. And then, you know, even the monetary policy comes, you know, quantitative easing. Well, it may not have benefited much in the real economy, but it seems to have benefited many people on Wall Street. So then it even concentrates more of the benefits of this system as it is into smaller and smaller and smaller spaces. And that's why we see all of these, you know, myriad economic difficulties, inflation puzzles, social problems, political problems, dissolutions. All of these things go back to the fact that, you know, for a very long time, we had a system in place that really didn't benefit people the way we were led to believe it did.
Yeah, and those people, those entities that structured how we do things now, correct me if I'm wrong, Jeff, but it would be your view that they didn't really understand the system. They didn't understand.
I don't think they wanted to, George. I think that's a big part of it is, you know, the way the policy was even described in the 1960s, they called it benign neglect. I mean, Paul Samuelson coined the term, which was essentially, we don't want to know. You know, Lynn mentioned Triffin's paradox.
It's like the monkey thing, right?
Just exactly. You know, the Eurodollar was essentially this benign neglect, which was the government saying, we have no idea. We have this current account problem. We don't even really know what it is. We can't account for it. We've got central banks swapping dollars all over Europe. And so we don't really know how to solve Triffin's dilemma, but the banking system seems to be doing it without us. So we won't ask any questions. Just let it happen. Let the bank sort out the details. And as long as it throws off these benefits, then who cares, right? I mean, that's really what benign neglect was. And I think, you know, a point Lynn pointed out earlier, the early Eurodollar system did have a good use and good potential. That it was, you know, it allowed trade and globalization and good things to happen, productive types of activities that took place. But over time, like a lot of things, it just got out of control. It got in, you know, with nobody watching the wheel, it went into all sorts of, you know, qualitative as well as quantitative expansion. And it really did get out of hand and get into all into a degree of dysfunction that, you know, nobody anticipated, nobody seemed to care about. And because it was making a lot of people rich and doing a lot of things. Right. As it's going up, nobody wants to spoil the party. It's only after the party's over that we start asking questions. That's just basic human nature.
If you go back to the globalization angle, like who it benefits the most, right? So we often point out that, you know, we outsource a lot of our production and so we get cheaper goods and services back, which, you know, is partially true. But then it depends on who you're asking. So, for example, if you work on Wall Street, if you're, a doctor, if you work in government, you know, you didn't lose your job. And yet you get all the benefits of that, you know, the cheaper products and services. Yeah. However, if you were a manufacturer, if you were a blue collar worker, a skilled, you know, car maker or something, and then, you know, now they closed your plant and now they're making it in Mexico, you know, you're not benefiting from that slightly cheaper car in the same way, because you lost, you know, your income, or even if you still got another job, you have, you know, your ability to negotiate a better compensation package is damaged, because, you know, you can't go too high because they can easily go to Mexico and make that around you, right? So if you're kind of like in that bubble where you're totally unimpacted by any of the consequences, but then you get all the benefits of the cheaper goods, it's all good. You pretty much just win. Whereas if you're any one of that kind of the spectrum of people that have been impacted by that, it could even just be, you know, it's people that work in, you know, kind of manufacturing themselves, but then it's also a lot of the infrastructure around that. So if you were in a town, for example, and you worked at a restaurant that was kind of near the manufacturing place, but as that kind of industry died in that town, and then it spreads to all the different kind of, you know, the services around that town. So, you know, the restaurants in that town died and, you know, everything had to move. So all those people were impacted. So they're not really benefiting from the cheaper goods in the same way as someone that wasn't impacted with any of the downsides.
Yeah, but I don't think either of you guys would argue for a closed system either. So
no, what we're saying is we want broad-based benefits that are sustainable and legitimate. I think the point that Lynn is just making, let's extend it a little bit. The reason I think Americans in particular were willing to let this process play out was because the benefits were not, you know, not just, you know, cheaper goods and cheaper services, but then you also have rising access to credit, rising housing prices, rising, you know, other things, assets, Wall Street, stock market, these other things that made it seem like this is a good trade-off. You know, it masked the downside of globalization, which, you know, I would argue the zero-dollar system was bastardized globalization. It wasn't real globalization. It wasn't real trade, because real trade gets conducted on capital flows, which, you know, acts as a constraint. So we almost had unlimited capacity to do all sorts of transformations across all of these places. Okay. And I don't think most people understood the consequences of it, because look, you know, I lost my job at the factory, but I got a job working as a barista, but I also now have a housing, you know, the price of my house has gone way up that I can get a home equity line of credit against. So maybe things aren't so bad. And it really, you know, that only works for a while. And then when it stops working, then you're stuck. And then you start to question what went wrong, but you don't know what went wrong because so much time has passed and you don't really see cause versus effect, and you can't really trace one to the other. And so you start looking for all different kinds of answers. Who has solutions? Maybe this quantitative easing stuff will work. Maybe it won't. I mean, there's no real way to go from one dot to the other and connect everything into a nice, easy story that people can understand.
Globalization and a free market, free trade, let's say, between countries is a good thing, But in this case, the way it was done with this euro dollar system, kind of haphazard approach that just kind of formed or evolved out of necessity, the way it did things, it made it to where it was lopsided, to where there was, at least for the United States, it was a net negative instead of a positive. Is that what I'm hearing?
Yeah, go ahead, Lynn.
I was just going to say, in significant part. So, if you look at how most countries operate, right? If they, you know, running a persistent trade deficit, for example, often what happens is the next time they have some sort of recession or financial crisis, usually they have a, you know, some degree of currency devaluation. If they don't have a ton of external debt, that could be good, right? Because then it makes their exports more competitive. It reduces their import ability, which doesn't feel good at the time, but it basically helps the country realign between production and consumption, because mm-hmm. you know, they were consuming too much, they weren't producing enough, and then that kind of currency devaluation, as long as they don't have that debt, helps them kind of rebalance. The United States never gets that period of rebalancing, because you know the foreign dollar system is, there's so much persistent demand for dollars. And so we never get that correction. We never kind of say, okay, our currency, you know, devalued, so our import power is less and our exports are more competitive. We never get that kind of rebalancing cycle. So we just have decade after decade of kind of hollowing out our manufacturing base, running literally decades straight of persistent trade deficits.
Yeah, I would almost call it like silent rebalancing, right? Because we did get some rebalancing, but it was not an unemployment rebalancing, because that's usually what happens. As Lynn said, you know, you get to the recession and you have to deal with your current account deficits and you have to realign production with demand, except we never did that. Instead, we had this rebalance, as we talked about before, where the unemployment in the real economy and production, those kinds of things, the goods economy did take place. But on the other side of it, we didn't, you know, rebalance. We just got other jobs to replace them, low-level service sector jobs, fire jobs, those kinds of things. So it was a silent rebalancing that people, you know, I mean, because it was incremental, it was slow, it happened over time. You don't really realize it's happening as it's happening. And then when you get to the consequences of it, when it starts to fall apart, you have no answers for why things happen the way they are. And, you know, why are we stuck in this situation? Why can't we get out of it? It must be, you know, you don't really understand what, you know, cause versus effect. It's just the rebalancing kind of happened, but it didn't happen the way it should have happened, because under a true capitalist system, it's supposed to be a paying basis. It's supposed to be, if you want to import a lot of goods, then you better be able to pay your way through it. And you don't pay your way through it by this persistent demand for your currency. That's an artificial unconstraint that allows the system to go way beyond where it should have. The natural limit of this kind of a trading system was reached decades ago. And so it kept going and going and going, whereas under a capitalist paying system, it would have stopped a long time ago. And then we could have said, okay, what do we do now? You know, we can't compete with Mexico or China. Maybe there's a way forward other than to let just benign neglect, like the currency system, solve all our problems for us, because it doesn't solve problems.
Yeah, man, now this makes a lot of sense. I mean, this is, it's like the light bulb is going on in my head as I hear you guys speak. So I want to be cognizant of your time. To kind of end here, I'd like to go over, Jeff, you were saying that we can't really fix the system as is right now and have a permanent solution, because it's predicated upon the banking system, and that is inherently volatile, let's say. So we'd need preferably we'd have a system outside of the banking system. So my first question would be, what does that look like? And then I'd like to get both of your feedback on if we can transition to a better system smoothly. Is there a way to do that? Or are we just, the only way to transition is if the whole thing collapses and we rebuild it like the phoenix coming out of the ashes?
I hope not. I hope that's not the transition, but it's a difficult thing. And it starts with, you know, recognizing the problem as it is and recognizing right. that there is a problem. And if we wait for politicians to get their heads out of their asses and say, okay, we need to do something, then maybe that's what we're left with doing, that the crisis, you know, the next big crisis is what finally convinces them they need to do something. So,
and that's probably your animosity towards the Fed, right? I mean, you're always very emotional when you talk about the Fed with Emil and whatnot, but that's probably the crux of it, isn't it? Because you see the problem, it's so obvious to you, but they're ignoring the problem, just making it worse.
It's worse. I mean, this grand strategy review has really got me going, because they're doing everything they can to avoid. All the evidence is pointing back at them, and so they're doing everything they can to avoid the truth, which is monetary policy doesn't work. The banking system is malfunctioning. We need to do something about it. And so they flatten the Phillips curve. They come up with this R-star nonsense, all this other crap, just so they can avoid what all the evidence is showing them. And so, you know, back to your other question, where do we go from here? I think we transition to a world, hopefully, that is based in some way on digital currency, blockchain, whatever it might be. I don't necessarily believe that it might be Bitcoin, but I think there's value in the Bitcoin technology. There's definitely value in blockchain technology, maybe an iteration or two down the road. There is definitely a way to do a currency system that is non-bank centered. And if you really think about it, blockchain, if you use blockchain as a payments base, you know, to account for all the payments that flow throughout the economy, we don't even need banks anymore. We can have a bankless monetary system that would actually, I believe, function, assuming that we could set it up in the right manner. And in right manner is a loaded term that, you know, opens all sorts of Pandora's boxes. But I think there's a way to do this, a digital currency way, so that it can be dependable, predictable, and operate in a steady fashion, a sustainably steady fashion that solves a lot of the basic issues with the Eurodollar system. I don't think it'll necessarily be perfect, but we can't let perfect be the enemy of good here.
Right. Wow, that's a bombshell right there, Jeff. I've never heard you talk about a currency or like a digital or cryptocurrency like that. Very cool. Lynn, what do you think about that?
I think so. I think the kind of the solution could take multiple forms. And I think it depends partially how far you look out and then how optimistic you are about kind of policymakers around the world kind of agreeing on a shared system or just kind of breaking apart. Because I think one thing we're seeing now is we're seeing sort of a slight transition towards multipolar, you know, kind of oil pricing and commodity pricing. And I think it's one of those things where a currency inherently has a big network effect, especially, you know, the global reserve currency. So the more dollars were used, the more we build up kind of offshore dollar debt, and then the more demand is for dollars, and it kind of entrenches itself. And it's a really kind of hard ship to turn. And we're starting to, it's become such a problem that we're starting to see kind of signs that many countries are kind of starting to kind of emphasize that more and more. So it starts, of course, with the countries that are more adversarial to the U.S. So we've seen, you know, Russia de-dollarize. They've pressed to do more of their trade in euros and other currencies. We've seen, for example, 2 years ago, the trade between Russia and China was almost entirely dollar based, and now it's less than half dollar based. And euros actually just overtook dollars, for the trade that happens between those countries. And you know, now we're seeing kind of drama around the Nord Stream 2 pipeline, right? So there's all sort of those geopolitical kind of chessboard stuff that different countries are kind of aiming for. And whether or not the U.S. goes along with it or kind of sanctions things like that, it's kind of like the last gasps of a system that's not really working anymore. And, you know, people have kind of different levels of understanding of who it benefits and whether or not they want to end the system and how they want to end it. So I think kind of a messy outcome is just a more kind of a multipolar system where you have kind of a little bit of a increase in diversification of the types of currencies that are used to buy, you know, oil, essentially. But then, you know, kind of in that world, you shift more towards neutral settlement, right? So we're seeing kind of central banks kind of gravitate a little bit towards gold here. We're seeing kind of because it's kind of a counterparty free, kind of, there's no counterparty risk there. They have kind of their own sort of partially inflation adjusted kind of asset sitting on their central bank balance sheet. But then, yeah, I think if you kind of do it better than that, you kind of, if there's some sort of unification, some sort of agreement to kind of deal with the system, then I think you can get into better constructed kind of systems where you have more of a neutral settlement, you know, kind of layer. You don't have kind of so much reliance on one country's currency and all the sort of associated problems that come with that.
Okay. So I think the main takeaway there is we could have a solution, but the smoothness or lack of smoothness with the transition is dependent upon politicians being intelligent and working together. So yeah, that's what the listener needs to weigh the probabilities there, which in my mind is about as close to zero as you can get.
Yeah, unfortunately, that's the reality of the situation, right? I mean, we're depending. Yeah. I mean, we really can't do anything without the public sector. I mean, there are some things that we can do. I mean, you can have private currency spring up, but without participation of the public sector, it's much less likely to succeed in any long-term fashion. So ideally, you want some kind of public-private partnership where the private side realizes that, you know, going forward, we want to have a stable system. And the public side realizes that they're not going to have complete control over it. have some input, some kind of, you know, policy advice, some kind of actionable ways to get into the system, but it cannot be one or either or situation where it's all public or all private. It's got to be some kind of partnership, because that's what will make it sustainable and stable.
For the sake of time, we'll go ahead and leave it there. I've got about 100 more questions, and I think we've opened up an avenue to about 15 more conversations just like this on other topics, such as digital currency, the global currency, or the global world reserve currency, whatnot. But I want to personally thank both of you for doing this. This was just an honor to sit here and get to listen to both of you and ask questions. I'm a huge fan of both your work, and I know everyone that watches this or listens to this is just going to be so excited, and they're just going to gain so much value from this back and forth. So thank you both for your time and for your willingness to do this.
Thanks, George. Appreciate it.
Yeah. Thanks for having me. And thanks, Jeff, for the chat. I really appreciated all this.
Yeah, you too.
And guys, just in closing, for the viewers who want to find out more about what you do, where can they go to check that out? The website, the Twitter, you guys can, let's go through all that.
Go ahead, Jeff.
Oh, I'm at alhambrapartners.com, which is Alhambra Investments. I'm the head of global research there. You can follow me on Twitter at Jeff Snyder_AIP.
Okay.
And I'm at lynnalden.com, and I'm on Twitter at lynnaldencontact.
Thank you for listening to the Rebel Capitalist Show. For more content like this, check out the Rebel Capitalist blog at georgegammon.com or go to the George Gammon YouTube channel.